The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Exchange. It's a big day for investors and for Washington. The CEOs of the world's biggest tech companies are about to testify before the House Antitrust Subcommittee. It was supposed to begin an hour ago. It was delayed. That's why we're here now. But it should begin any moment, as you just saw from that live shot of what's going on Capitol Hill. This is the first time that all four executives, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Apple's Tim Cook, and Google's Sundar Pichai, the first time they've all testified together. And it's the first time that Bezos has ever testified before Congress. Now, the concerns by Congress range from anti-competitive acquisitions to data collection practices to price fixing and supplier pressures. And when we say that these companies are big, we mean very big. Three of them have a market cap over a trillion. Apple's the largest at 1.6 trillion, and only Facebook is below the trillion mark threshold. Let's dig into what we can expect and what's at stake. And for that, we turn to Elizabeth Dwoskin, the Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. William Kovacic is former chairman of the FTC and a law professor at George Washington University. And Ed Lee is corporate media reporter at The New York Times and a CNBC contributor. Ed, I'll turn to you first because we've got you a visual of you. And what exactly is your expectation for where the line of questioning will start and what the most important objective is here today?
So, look, I think this is a few things. Like the thing is going to happen over a Cisco Webex call. So it's not going to be the same sort of in-person kind of sweat on the brow kind of moment that you might see in other hearings. So that's it changes the drama element a little bit. Look, it's an election year, right? So a lot of these guys, they're going to grandstand for a few minutes before whether it's Bezos or Sundar or Tim Cook or Mark can actually answer the question. So there's going to be some grandstanding. I think they're going to have smarter questions this time around than we've seen in the past, just to show that they understand what the contours are. And then we'll see how serious they are about, thinking about antitrust and whether there needs to be different kinds of legislation or different kinds of enforcement. I'm expecting mostly theater to start.
Interesting. William Kovacic, let me turn to you and also mention this tweet by the president just in the past half an hour or so. It gets into this kind of battle between and among regulators as to how there is a government response to big tech here. The president said, if Congress doesn't bring fairness to big tech, which they should have done years ago, I will do it myself with executive orders. And Washington has been all talk and no action for years. And the people of our country are sick and tired of it. You're formerly with the FTC. Ben Thompson of Strategery today makes the argument that this response should be led by Congress because it's going to require new laws and not just remedies like fines that we might have seen in the past. Who do you think is the most effective body to deal with big tech?
It's a combination of both. The public agencies, the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice and the state attorneys general are currently running major investigations, which I think are going to result in cases in this calendar year. They are going to be the first to act, and that's a crucial element of the regulatory process. So the notion that nothing's going on, I think, is mistaken. Indeed, my guess is that by the time the election takes place, we're going to see big cases running from the federal and state antitrust enforcement agencies.
Well, go ahead. And I suppose my follow-up question in that regard would be, okay, so we have these cases by the states. What power do they have and what results are they trying to achieve?
They have the power to, the states and the feds both have the power to impose structural remedies, that is to restructure companies, to impose controls on conduct, and to change the way the firms operate. And there's evidence from a lot of past experience that that can have a big impact on the companies. And again, I think that's going to happen this year, soon.
Interesting. Elizabeth, let me turn to you with one of the larger questions that looms over what happens with big tech, and it's whether antitrust law continues to change or evolve so that it's not the consumer harm that needs to be demonstrated, but more just the competitive harm. Are we headed down that path? Do you expect to hear questions that hint in that direction, and what happens if so?
Yeah, that is, to me, one of the key questions around some of the cases, particularly at the FTC. What I've heard from sources is that right now, the government agencies that are the FTC that is investigating Facebook, for example, their view of the harm to consumers is very much focused on still on price. So it's this idea of if the service is free, how can you harm a consumer by hiking up prices on them because you're a monopoly? You can't, because the service is free. However, there are readings of antitrust law that find that there's harms to innovation, there's harms to competition, there's harms to the American economy, there's other ways to hurt consumers. Another thing you could say about some of these companies who serve free services is that when they become so dominant, they get to do effectively whatever they want with your data. So there's a harm to your data because you can't easily connect with people or use other services. So I don't see, from what I'm hearing, those kind of arguments really rising to the fore in the government agencies where they're doing the investigations. But I think definitely it's going to come up at the hearing today, and that's going to cement an idea potentially in the public eye of the kinds of harms that these companies can cause.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to go back to that idea of consumer harm, Ed, and read the opening statement by Jeff Bezos, which, in fact, we are about to hear both from the big tech CEOs. And we'll begin, actually, with the subcommittee chair, David Cicilline, his opening statement as the hearing gets underway.
In September 2019, the chairman and ranking members of the full committee and the subcommittee issued sweeping bipartisan requests for information to the four firms that will testify at today's hearing. Since then, we've received millions of pages of evidence from these firms, as well as documents and submissions from more than 100 market participants. We also conducted hundreds of hours of interviews. As part of this investigation, we have held 5 hearings to examine the effects of online market power on innovation and entrepreneurship, data privacy, a free and diverse press, and independent businesses in the online marketplace. We've held 17 briefings and roundtables with over 35 experts and stakeholders in support of our work. This investigation has been bipartisan from the start. It's been an honor to work alongside my colleague, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, the subcommittee's ranking member, as well as the former ranking member of the full committee, Congressman Doug Collins. We work closely with all members of the subcommittee on both sides of the aisle who have taken this work seriously and studied these issues carefully. As my colleague, Congressman Ken Buck, recently commented, and I quote, "This is the most bipartisan effort that I've been involved with in 5.5 years of Congress," end quote. The purpose of today's hearing is to examine the dominance of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Amazon runs the largest online marketplace in America, capturing 70% of all online marketplace sales. It operates across a vast array of businesses, from cloud computing and movie production to transportation logistics and small business lending. Amazon's market valuation recently hit $1.5 trillion, more than that of Walmart, Target, Salesforce, IBM, eBay, and Etsy combined. Apple is a dominant provider of smartphones, with more than 100 million iPhone users in the United States alone. In addition to hardware, Apple sells services and apps, including financial services, media, and games. Facebook is the world's largest provider of social networking services, with a business model that sells digital ads. Despite a litany of privacy scandals and record-breaking fines, Facebook continues to enjoy booming profits, $18 billion last year alone. Lastly, Google is the world's largest online search engine, capturing more than 90% of searches online. It controls key technologies and digital ad markets and enjoys more than 1 billion users across 6 products, including browsers, smartphones, and digital maps. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, these corporations already stood out as titans in our economy. In the wake of COVID-19, however, they're likely to emerge stronger and more powerful than ever before. As American families shift more of their work, shopping, and communication online, these giants stand to profit. Locally owned businesses, meanwhile, mom-and-pop stores on Main Street, face an economic crisis unlike any in recent history. As hard it is to believe, it's possible that our economy will emerge from this crisis even more concentrated and consolidated than before. These companies serve as critical arteries of commerce and communications. Because these companies are so central to our modern life, their business practices and decisions have an outsized effect on our economy and our democracy. any single action by one of these companies can affect hundreds of millions of us in profound and lasting ways. Although these four corporations differ in important and meaningful ways, we've observed common patterns and competition problems over the course of this investigation. First, each platform is a bottleneck for a key channel of distribution. Whether they control access to information or to a marketplace, these platforms have the incentive and ability to exploit this power. They can charge exorbitant fees, impose oppressive contracts, and extract valuable data from the people and businesses that rely on them. Second, each platform uses its control over digital infrastructure to surveil other companies, their growth, business activity, and whether they might pose a competitive threat. Each platform has used this data to protect its power by either buying, copying, or cutting off access for any actual or potential rival. Third, these platforms abuse their control over current technologies to extend their power, whether it's through self-preferencing, predatory pricing, or requiring users to buy additional products. The dominant platforms have wielded their power in destructive, harmful ways in order to expand. At today's hearing, we'll examine how each of these companies has used this playbook to achieve and maintain dominance and how their power shapes and affects our daily lives. So why does this matter? Many of the practices used by these companies have harmful economic effects. They discourage entrepreneurship, destroy jobs, hike costs, and degrade quality. Simply put, they have too much power. This power staves off new forms of competition, creativity, and innovation. And while these dominant firms may still produce some new innovative products, their dominance is killing the small businesses, manufacturing, and overall dynamism that are the engines of the American economy. Several of these firms also harvest and abuse people's data to sell ads for everything from new books to dangerous so-called miracle cures. When everyday Americans learn how much of their data is being mined, they can't run away fast enough. But in many cases, there is no escape from the surveillance because there's no alternative. People are stuck with bad options. Open markets are predicated on the idea that if a company harms people, consumers, workers, and business partners will choose another option. We're here today because that choice is no longer possible. In closing, I'm confident that addressing the problems we see in these markets will lead to a stronger, more vibrant economy. Because concentrated economic power also leads to concentrated political power, this investigation also goes to the heart of whether we, as a people, govern ourselves or whether we let ourselves be governed by private monopolies. American democracy has always been at war against monopoly power. Throughout our history, we've recognized that concentrated markets and concentrated political control are incompatible with democratic ideals. When the American people confronted monopolists in the past, be it the railroads or the oil tycoons or AT&T and Microsoft, we took action to ensure no private corporation controls our economy or our democracy. We face similar challenges today. As gatekeepers of the digital economy, these platforms enjoy the power to pick winners and losers, to shake down small businesses, and enrich themselves while choking off competitors. Their ability to dictate terms, call the shots, upend entire sectors, and inspire fear represent the powers of a private government. Our founders would not bow before a king, nor should we bow before the emperors of the online economy. And with that, I now recognize the ranking member of the subcommittee, Mr. Sensenbrenner, for his opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the CEOs for quickly working with the subcommittee to appear today. The memorial service for John Lewis on Monday required our attention. However, this hearing is vital to our oversight work, and I appreciate your flexibility. Throughout my long time in Congress, I have prioritized oversight as one of our seminal responsibilities. Part of that responsibility is to periodically review the effectiveness of our laws. And I think it's a good and timely thing that we are now turning our attention to technological innovations, which brings us to all of your companies. Our country stricken by a pandemic becomes a dramatic illustration of the extraordinary reliance Americans have on technological innovations. In these unexpected and unprecedented times, your companies have provided innovations so our nations can meet a myriad of our daily needs. The delivery of groceries, virtual visits with doctors, connecting socially distant families, or keeping our small and large businesses connected. With that responsibility comes an increased scrutiny of your dominance in the marketplace. I want to reiterate something I've said throughout this investigation. Being big is not inherently bad. Quite the opposite. In America, you should be rewarded for success. We are here to better understand the role your companies have in the digital marketplace, and importantly, the effect they have on consumers and the public at large. You lead some of today's more powerful companies, and my colleagues and I have a great interest about what your companies do with that accumulated power. We also know that the tech marketplace is driven by data. So it follows that those who control the data, in essence, control the marketplace. There are broader questions surrounding data, however. Who owns the data? What responsibilities do companies have to share it with their customers or their competitors? What is the fair market value of that data? Is there anything monopolistic in acquiring this data? And what about monetizing it? These are complex issues that Congress, regulators, and even your own companies are wrestling with in the current technological landscape, and the answers to which we owe the American consumers. Since the tech investigation began, we have heard rumblings from many who are quick to say your successful companies have grown too large. Since this hearing was announced, it seems that those complaints have gotten even louder. While I find these complaints informative, I don't plan on litigating each of these complaints today. Antitrust law and the consumer welfare standard have served this country well for over a century. Those laws have provided the framework and creativity to make way for some of our most successful and innovative companies. I will be the first to highlight that. However, as the business landscape evolves, we must ensure that our existing antitrust laws are applied to meet the needs of our country and its consumers. I share the concern that market dominance in the digital space is ripe for abuse, particularly when it comes to free speech. As we know, companies like Facebook, Google's YouTube, and Twitter have become the public square of today where political debate unfolds in real time. But reports that dissenting views, often conservative views, are targeted or censored is seriously troubling. Conservatives are consumers too, and they need the protection of the antitrust laws. The power to influence debate carries with it remarkable responsibilities. So let the facts be our guide here. Your companies are large. That's not a problem. Your companies are successful. That's not a problem either. But I want to leave here today with a more complete picture of how your individual companies use your size, success, and power, and what it means to the American consumer. And I yield back the balance of my time.
I thank the gentleman. Now the chair now recognizes the distinguished chairman of the full committee, the gentleman from New York, Mr. Nadler, for his opening statement.
We're going to pick it back up here, get a little bit of reaction to what we've just heard from both sides of the aisle. Again, we heard from the chair, David Sensenbrenner, a Democrat. We just heard from Jim Sensenbrenner, who is a Republican, and both laid out different philosophical approaches to what they will be asking and hope to hear from the big tech executives on Capitol Hill today. I want to run all of this by our group who's still here with us, Elizabeth Dwoskin, William Kovacic, Ed Lee, along with our reporters, Kayla Tausche, Deirdre Bosa, Julia Borston, and Josh Lipton. Kayla, let me start with you. You know, we heard from Cicilline basically a reminder of all the market power that these big companies have. From Sensenbrenner, we heard a little bit more moderation. He said, you know, your size is not a problem. Your success is not a problem. I want to understand more about how you use that size and success. And of course, he emphasized some of the free speech issues and other sort of bias concerns that conservatives have when it comes to these platforms. That, to me, suggests that there's still a fair amount of distance between the two parties as to what the first move might be on big tech.
Well, Kelly, they agree that there could potentially be problems with market dominance. On the left, they believe that the dominance could have issues with data and surveillance of customers. On the right, it has to do with free speech and conservative ideas being shared on the platforms. That being said, you did hear the chairman of the subcommittee, David Cicilline, talking about how these companies are gatekeepers to the digital economy and talking about comparisons to railroad and oil tycoons of the prior century and the ability, especially after the pandemic, for these 800-pound gorillas to use their power for evil. We did see that contrasted from ranking member Sensenbrenner's comments following that. But certainly these executives are going to have a lot of tough questions to answer. We are coming off of dozens of hearings on this topic already, millions of pages of data having been provided to the committee. And they've already heard from deputies and division heads at these companies and been able to craft fairly educated questions for this moment right now with the heads of these companies in front of them or on camera, rather, on Cisco WebEx, to actually answer all of these questions that they've had close to a year to put together. To be sure, these companies are set to say, we've had humble beginnings. These are only in America success stories, and we're actually quite different from company standpoints. Apple says it's a hardware company. Facebook says it's a community platform. And Apple and Amazon and Alphabet, rather, talk about their research and development. So they're going to try to carve out their own lane, but they are all going to be on the hot seat today.
Yeah,
Kelly?
Ed Lee, who would you say is kind of the first and foremost concern among regulators? Because they are going to take a differentiated approach to each company here. There's not one issue that really unites them. Is it Google? Is it Apple? And would we expect Tim Cook, for instance, to try to turn the narrative back towards the practices of Facebook and Google in order to deflect from the real concerns and questions that are going to be asked about their market power as it relates to the App Store?
I think they all are. But if we're going to pick a few, I do think Apple on one hand and also Amazon on the other. You know, Bezos, as you guys pointed out, he hasn't testified before Congress before. So I think they're going to really take that opportunity. He's also the richest of a group of very rich people. Regarding sort of the different approaches here, I want to point out, I don't know if people have noticed, but the woman sitting behind the chairman, Chairman Cicilline, is Lina Khan, who is the law school professor who wrote this sort of famous paper, mm-hmm. Yale Law Review, about sort of the antitrust paradox around Amazon. So these behemoths that, you know, are growing really big and strong, but, you know, are charging less and less and or free services to consumers. And she was sort of taking a different view of antitrust law. It's like, hey, we should try to apply it differently. Maybe we've been applying it using sort of the Bork standard, right? Where do these big companies, do they lower costs for consumers? If so, that's fine. Before Bork, though, there was a different reading of antitrust law where it was largely around, well, are they just getting too big and crowding out other potential competitors? And I think there is, you know, if you're looking at the Democrats, they're looking for more that the reading from Professor Khan, who, you know what, we should take a broader view and instead of simply does it lower prices, because that's what all these guys are going to talk about. They're going to talk about how Amazon has lowered prices for consumers, how Apple has made things better for consumers. Facebook is free. Google is free. So I think that's what's going to be challenged, at least from the Democrat side.
And William Kovacic, on that note, if they do go down this path of reexamining government power as it relates to breaking up companies for reasons that aren't just consumer harm, does it open the door towards using this power in a way that might achieve other social issues? And is that a path we want to go down?
To ascertain the facts and to make recommendations based on those findings.
We'll check your audio, sir. We'll be right back with you. Kailal, I'll turn back to you and ask that question as well. I mean, what are the rumblings on Capitol Hill about just how far not just the antitrust law could go as it relates to big tech, but whether this does start to set a precedent for the way we might see antitrust power used in the future?
Laws begin with them.
Caleb?
Kelly, well, I think that it really depends on what happens in November, right? Because right now you have a Democratic House, you have a Republican Senate, and there is very little that the two sides can agree on. And we've seen that come to a head in recent months over some of these stimulus packages, not least of which this issue is a galvanizing issue for both sides of the aisle. And also what happens in the presidential election, because the FTC, DOJ, you know, the agencies with jurisdiction over a lot of these issues could get new leadership themselves come early next year. And it's not expected that there's much that could be done between now and November. We've seen the rubber takes quite a long time to meet the road on all of these issues, especially with billions of dollars of lobbying money being thrown behind this effort from Silicon Valley, too.
Yeah. And Deirdre, on that note, I've seen the opening statement from Jeff Bezos of Amazon. The opening statements from all of these executives are out. What are the most important themes you expect Amazon and Google in particular to hit here?
Well, a common theme across all of them, and this was mentioned earlier, is they're basically talking about their own experience, how they were able to achieve the American dream, how they've come from humble beginnings. I thought it was so interesting that Representative Cicilline talked about some of the common threads that they found throughout this 13 months long investigation. He said key bottlenecks next. These companies have the incentive and the ability to exploit their power. He also talked about harmful economic effects, such as destroying jobs and hindering entrepreneurships. When you look at Jeff Bezos's prepared remarks, he addresses these issues head on. Amid the pandemic, Amazon has been hiring tens of thousands of workers. He would argue that they promote entrepreneurship through their third-party merchants. So they have their remarks prepared. They know what's coming. You get the lawmakers will have to dig in deeper and talk about some of these nuances that are becoming more and more clear to consumers. For Amazon, for example, how they use their data to potentially compete with their third-party merchants, how consumers perhaps aren't getting the best or the right products because Amazon is promoting its own. So those are some of the arguments that we'll hear from Bezos, and I think we'll hear them across from other CEOs, too. Certainly, Sundar Pichai talks about how he grew up in India with little access to a computer, arriving in the United States and being blown away by full labs filled with computers. So certainly these are some of the themes, Kelly.
Yeah, for Facebook, Julia, and Google in particular, as Jim Jordan is charging, he says the Internet is censoring conservatives. Are these companies prepared to demonstrate that they do not have a bias against speech that they disagree with?
I expect they anticipated that attack. This is an argument that they've been dealing with for quite a long time. And it's really interesting. If you look at the allegations of conservative bias, also concerns about the spread of hate speech, though these are not intrinsically about antitrust, we do expect those issues to be in focus, particularly for Google, as well as its YouTube unit, as well as for Facebook, Kelly.
Right. Although, again, you know, we've seen them try to deflect these concerns in the past, but not, you know, substantively. And Mark Zuckerberg in particular has been kind of out of the consensus on his stand for free speech when it pertains to political advertising and the rest of it. So do you expect him to have a different philosophical take here than we might hear from, say, Sundar Pichai at Google?
Yes, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg has been really distinguished, particularly when it comes to this issue of free speech. And he really has stood by the fact that he wants us to be a free and open platform. There's intrinsic value, he believes, in Facebook offering free speech. On the other end of that spectrum, though, is how much they're willing to censor offensive content, hateful content, racist content. And this has been a line that they've been really grappling with right now. In particular, there is this boycott of advertisers of Facebook, a number of hundreds of major brands boycotting Facebook in the month of July to push Facebook to take a stand on the issue of racist content on the platform. So I think that Zuckerberg is trying to be cognizant of the fact that he has to speak to both issues, the need for free speech, and the fact that they're also going to pull down offensive content. And then at the same time, there's this allegation that they're pulling down conservative content more than they are content on the other side of the aisle. So a lot of different things for him to balance, all issues that he's been faced with in the past. But I think that right now in particular, Facebook earnings are tomorrow. A lot of the questions are going to mention the fact that they're incredibly profitable, and then also the fact that they have this boycott going on, a number of balls in the air for Zuckerberg.
Ed Lee, I mean, there is a lot of support for these big four companies. The favorability ratings are very high, even with all the drama around a company like Facebook over the last couple of years. How important is that going to be for lawmakers who want to have an issue in an election year that is going to be broadly appealing?
So you point out something I think that's important, which is consumers like the products, but they don't necessarily like the executives running those products, right? So even if people sort of Facebook or Instagram, you know, that they're heavy users of which there are billions, they may not like Mark Zuckerberg, or they may not like the controversy around it. So I think part of what's happening here in these hearings is holding these people to account as much as the companies. And I think because, you know, the way that Silicon Valley startups sort of sprang into existence was very much sort of a founder ethos, right? So Mark Zuckerberg is equated with Facebook. They're essentially one of the same. I think Google and Apple have sort of matured on where they have these sort of executives in place. So I think that is sort of the nuance here in terms of what's being criticized and what potential political points that, you know, people might be trying to score. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the point of this hearing. I think there are some real legitimate concerns that you're trying to get at. But that is, I think, the nuance in terms of, you know, trying to separate the person, these billionaires, yeah, from, you know, the products that people use.
All right. Let's turn back to the hearing where the CEOs themselves are about to deliver their opening statements. The first up is Jeff Bezos, who has never before testified on Capitol Hill, the founder and CEO of Amazon. Let's listen in.
Mr. Bezos founded Amazon in 19... Excuse me, I'm going to remind members of this committee, unless you are speaking, our rules require you to wear a mask according to the attending physician. No, I'm speaking about another member of this committee. I'll begin again. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's witnesses. Our first witness is Jeff Bezos, the chief executive officer of Amazon.com. Mr. Bezos founded Amazon in 1994 as an online bookstore. Since then, Amazon has grown to be the largest online retailer on the internet. Mr. Bezos has also oversees his company's expansion into areas including cloud computing, digital streaming, and artificial intelligence. Mr. Bezos received his Bachelor's of Science from Princeton University. Our second witness, Sundar Pichai, is the chief executive officer of both Alphabet and its subsidiary, Google. Mr. Pichai joined Google in 2004 and has helped manage a number of successful products, including Google Chrome, Gmail, and the Android operating system. Mr. Pichai also oversaw the company's popular search products. Prior to his time at Google, Mr. Pichai worked in management consulting at McKinsey. Mr. Pichai received a degree in metallurgical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology, a master's degree from Stanford University, and an MBA from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Our third witness is Tim Cook, the chief executive officer of Apple. Mr. Cook joined Apple in 1998 and served as its chief operational officer until under Steve Jobs. In 2011, Mr. Cook was named CEO. While at Apple, he has overseen their expansion into new markets through the launch and developments of products and services like Apple Pay, Apple Watch, iCloud, Apple Card, and HomePod. Prior to joining Apple, Mr. Cook served as the Director of North American Fulfillment for IBM. Mr. Cook received a Bachelor of Science from Auburn University and an MBA from Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. The last witness at today's hearing is Mark Zuckerberg, founder, chairman, and CEO of Facebook. Mr. Zuckerberg initially launched Facebook in order to help connect college students at his school more easily. Since then, the company has grown into the world's largest social media platform with 1.7 billion global daily active users. Mr. Zuckerberg attended Harvard University before leaving to focus full-time on developing Facebook. We welcome all of our distinguished witnesses and thank them for participating in today's hearing. And now we'll begin by swearing you in. And before I do that, I want to also remind you that you are the only ones from your respective companies invited to testify today, and that in accordance with normal House practice and Section G of the House Remote Committee Proceeding Regulations, your sworn testimony must be your own. Please let me know if at any point in the hearing you wish to mute yourself so you can confer with your counsel. So will you please unmute your microphones and raise your right hands? Do you swear or affirm under penalty of perjury that the testimony you are out to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge, information, and belief, so help you God?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Let the record show the witnesses answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and you may remain seated. Please note that your written statements will be entered into the record in their entirety. Accordingly, I ask that you summarize your testimony in 5 minutes. To help you stay within that time, there is a timing light in WebEx. When the light switches from green to yellow, you have 1 minute to conclude your testimony. When the light turns red, it signals your 5 minutes have expired. Mr. Bezos, you may begin.
Thank you, Chairman Cicilline, Ranking Member Sensenbrenner, and members of the subcommittee. I was born into great wealth, not monetary wealth, but instead the wealth of a loving family, a family that fostered my curiosity and encouraged me to dream big. My mom, Jackie, had me when she was a 17-year-old high school student in Albuquerque. Being pregnant in high school was not popular. The school tried to kick her out, but she was allowed to finish after my grandfather negotiated terms with the principal. She couldn't have a locker, no extracurriculars, and couldn't walk across the stage to get her diploma. She graduated and was determined to continue her education, so she enrolled in night school, bringing me, her infant son, to class with her throughout. My dad's name is Miguel. He adopted me when I was 4. He was 16 when he came to the U.S. from Cuba by himself shortly after Castro took over. My dad didn't speak English, and he did not have an easy path. What he did have was grit and determination. He received a scholarship to college in Albuquerque, which is where he met my mom. Together with my grandparents, these hardworking, resourceful, and loving people made me who I am. I walked away from a steady job on Wall Street into a Seattle garage to found Amazon, fully understanding that it might not work. It feels like just yesterday I was driving the packages to the post office myself, dreaming that one day we might afford a forklift. Customer obsession has driven our success, and I take it as an article of faith that customers notice when you do the right thing. You earn trust slowly over time by doing hard things well, delivering on time, offering everyday low prices, making promises and keeping them, and making principled decisions, even when they are unpopular. And our approach is working. 80% of Americans have a favorable impression of Amazon overall. Who do Americans trust more than Amazon to do the right thing? Only their doctors and the military. The retail market we participate in is extraordinarily large and competitive. Amazon accounts for less than 1% of the $25 trillion global retail market and less than 4% of U.S. retail. There's room in retail for multiple winners. We compete against large, established players like Target, Costco, Kroger, and, of course, Walmart, a company more than twice Amazon's size. 20 years ago, we made the decision to invite other sellers to sell in our store to share the same valuable real estate we spent billions to build, market, and maintain. We believe that combining the strengths of Amazon's store with the vast selection of products offered by third parties would be a better experience for customers, and that the growing pie of revenue and profits would be big enough for all. We were betting that it was not a zero-sum game. Fortunately, we were right. There are now 1.7 million small and medium-sized businesses selling on Amazon. The trust customers put in us every day has allowed Amazon to create more jobs in the United States over the past decade than any other company. Hundreds of thousands of jobs across 42 states. Amazon employees make a minimum of $15 an hour, more than double the federal minimum wage. And we offer the best benefits. Benefits that include comprehensive health insurance, 401k retirement, and parental leave, which includes 20 weeks of paid maternity leave. More than any place on earth, entrepreneurial companies start, grow, and thrive here in the U.S. We nurture entrepreneurs and startups with stable rule of law, the finest university system in the world, the freedom of democracy, and a deeply accepted culture of risk-taking. Of course, this great nation of ours is far from perfect. Even as we remember Congressman John Lewis and honor his legacy, we're in the middle of a much-needed race reckoning. We also face the challenges of climate change and income inequality, and we're stumbling through the crisis of a global pandemic. Still, with all of our faults and problems, the rest of the world would love even the tiniest sip of the elixir we have here in the U.S. Immigrants like my dad see what a treasure this country is. They have perspective and often can see it even more clearly than those of us who were lucky enough to be born here. It is still day one for this country, and even in the face of today's humbling challenges, I have never been more optimistic about our future. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'm very happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bezos. Mr. Bachai, you are now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Sensenbrenner, and members of the subcommittee. Before I start, I know this hearing was delayed because of the ceremonies to honor the life of your colleague, Representative John Lewis. Because of his courage, this world is a better place. He'll be deeply missed. At its heart, a discussion about competition is a discussion about opportunity. This has never been more important as the global pandemic poses dual challenges to our health and our economy. Expanding access to opportunity through technology is personal to me. I didn't have much access to a computer growing up in India. So you can imagine my amazement when I arrived in the US for graduate school and saw an entire lab of computers to use whenever I wanted. Accessing the internet for the first time set me on a path to bring technology to as many people as possible. It inspired me to build Google's first browser, Chrome. I'm proud that 11 years later, so many people experience the web through Chrome for free. Google takes pride in the number of people who choose our products. We are even prouder of what they do with them. From the 140 million students and teachers using G Suite for education to stay connected during the pandemic, to the 5 million Americans gaining digital skills through Grow with Google, to all the people who turn to Google for help, from finding the fastest route home to learning how to cook a new dish on YouTube. Google's work would not be possible without the long tradition of American innovation, and we are proud to contribute to its future. They employ more than 75,000 people in the U.S. across 26 states. The Progressive Policy Institute estimated that in 2018, we invested more than $20 billion in the U.S., citing us as the largest capital investor in America that year, and one of the top five for the last 3 years. One way we contribute is by building helpful products. Research found that free services like Search, Gmail, Maps, and Photos provide thousands of dollars a year in value to the average American. And many are small businesses using our digital tools to grow. Stone Dimensions, a family-owned stone company in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, uses Google My Business to draw more customers. Gills Appliances, a family-owned appliance store in Bristol, Rhode Island, credits Google Analytics with helping them reach customers online during the pandemic. Nearly one-third of small business owners say that without digital tools, they would have had to close all or part of their business during COVID. Another way we contribute is by being among the world's biggest investors in research and development. At the end of 2019, our R&D spend had increased tenfold over 10 years, from $2.8 billion to $26 billion, and we have invested over $90 billion the last 5 years. Our engineers are helping America remain a global leader in emerging technologies like artificial intelligence, self-driving cars, and quantum computing. Just as America's technology leadership is not inevitable, Google's continued success is not guaranteed. New competitors emerge every day, and today users have more access to information than ever before. Competition drives us to innovate, and it also leads to better products, lower choices, and more choices for everyone. For example, competition helped lower online advertising costs by 40% over the last decade, with savings passed down to consumers. Open platforms like Android also support the innovation of others. Using Android, thousands of mobile operators build and sell their own devices without paying any licensing fees to us. This has enabled billions of consumers to afford cutting-edge smartphones, some for less than $50. Whether building tools for small businesses or platforms like Android, Google succeeds when others succeed. Competition also sets higher standards for privacy and security. I've always believed that privacy is a universal right, and Google is committed to keeping your information safe, treating it responsibly, putting you in control, and we've long supported the creation of comprehensive federal privacy laws. I've never forgotten how access to technology and innovation changed the course of my life. Google aims to build products that increase access to opportunity for everyone, no matter where you live, what you believe, or how much money you earn. We are committed to doing this responsibly in partnership with lawmakers to ensure every American has access to the incredible opportunity technology creates. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pichai. Mr. Cook is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Chairman Cicilline and Nadler, Ranking Member Sensenbrenner and Jordan, members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony. Before I begin, I want to recognize the life and legacy of John Lewis. I join you in mourning not only a hero, but someone I knew personally, whose example inspires and guides me still. Every American owes John Lewis a debt, and I feel fortunate to hail from a state and a country that benefited so profoundly from his leadership. My name is Tim Cook. I've been Apple CEO since 2011 and a proud employee of this uniquely American company since 1998. At Apple, we make ourselves a promise and our customers a promise. It's a promise that we'll only build things that make us proud. As Steve put it, we only make things that we'd recommend to our family and friends. You can try to define this difference in a lot of ways. You can call it the seamless integration of hardware and software. You can call it simplicity of design or a great ecosystem. All of those things are true. But if you want to put it simply, products like iPhone just work. When customers consistently give iPhone a 99% satisfaction rating, that's the message they're sending about the user experience. But we also know that customers have a lot of choices and that our products face fierce competition. Companies like Samsung, LG, Huawei, and Google have built successful businesses with different approaches. We're okay with that. Our goal is the best, not the most. In fact, we don't have a dominant share in any market or in any product category where we do business. What does motivate us is that timeless drive to build new things that we're proud to show our users. We focus relentlessly on those innovations, on deepening core principles like privacy and security, and on creating new features. In 2008, we introduced a new feature of the iPhone called the App Store. Launched with 500 apps, which seemed like a lot at the time, the App Store provided a safe and trusted way for users to get more out of their phone. We knew the distribution options for software developers at the time didn't work well. Brick and mortar stores charged high fees and had limited reach. Physical media like CDs had to be shipped and were hard to update. From the beginning, the App Store was a revolutionary alternative. App Store developers set prices for their apps and never pay for shelf space. We provide every developer with cutting-edge tools like compilers, programming languages, and more than 150,000 essential software building blocks called APIs. The App Store guidelines ensure a high-quality, reliable, and secure user experience. They are transparent and applied equally to every developer. For the vast majority of apps, developers keep 100% of the money they make. The only apps that are subject to a commission are those where the developer acquires a customer on an Apple device and where the features or services would be experienced and consumed on an Apple device. In the App Store's more than 10-year history, we have never raised the commission or added a single fee. In fact, we've reduced it for subscriptions and exempted additional categories of apps. I'm here today because scrutiny is reasonable and appropriate. We approach this process with respect and humility, but we make no concession on the facts. What began as 500 apps is now more than 1.7 million, only 60 of which are Apple software. If Apple is a gatekeeper, what we've done is open the gate wider. We want to get every app we can on the store, not keep them off. The App Store's economic contributions are significant. The ecosystem is responsible for 1.9 million jobs in all 50 states, and it facilitated $138 billion in commerce in the U.S. in 2019 alone. I share the committee's belief that competition promotes innovation, that it makes space for the next great idea, and that it gives consumers more choices. Since Apple was founded, these things have defined us. The first Mac brought opportunity and possibility into the home. The iPod helped musicians and artists to share their creations and be paid fairly for it. This legacy does much more than make us proud. It inspires us to work tirelessly to make sure tomorrow will be even better than today. Thank you very much. I look forward to responding to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Zuckerberg is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you. Before I begin, I want to add my voice to those honoring Congressman John Lewis and his service to our country. America has lost a real hero who never stopped fighting for the rights of every person. Chairman Cicilline, Ranking Member Sensenbrenner, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. The tech industry is an American success story. The products we build have changed the world and improved people's lives. Our industry is one of the ways that America shares its values with the world and one of our greatest economic and cultural exports. Facebook is part of this story. We started with an idea to give people the power to share and connect. And we've built services that billions of people find useful. I'm proud that we've given people who've never had a voice before the opportunity to be heard and given small businesses access to tools that only the largest players used to have. Since COVID emerged, I'm proud that people have used our services to stay in touch with friends and family who they can't be with in person, and to keep their small businesses running online when physical stores are closed. I believe that Facebook and the U.S. tech industry are a force for innovation and empowering people, but I recognize that there are concerns about the size and power of tech companies. Our services are about connection, and our business model is advertising, and we face intense competition in both. Many of our competitors have hundreds of millions or billions of users. Some are upstarts, but others are gatekeepers with the power to decide if we can even release our apps in their app stores to compete with them. In many areas, we're behind our competitors. The most popular messaging service in the U.S. is iMessage. The fastest growing app is TikTok. The most popular app for video is YouTube. The fastest growing ads platform is Amazon. The largest ads platform is Google. And for every dollar spent on advertising in the U.S., less than 10 cents is spent with us. We're here to talk about online platforms, but I think the true nature of competition is much broader. When Google bought YouTube, they could compete against the dominant player in video, which was the cable industry. When Amazon bought Whole Foods, they could compete against Kroger's and Walmart. When Facebook bought WhatsApp, we could compete against telcos who used to charge 10 cents a text message, but not anymore. Now people can watch video, get groceries delivered, and send private messages for free. That's competition. New companies are created all the time, all over the world. And history shows that if we don't keep innovating, someone will replace every company here today. And that change can often happen faster than you expect. Of the 10 most valuable companies a decade ago, only three still make that list today. And if you look at where the top technology companies come from, a decade ago, the vast majority were American. Today, almost half are Chinese. Aside from competition, there are other serious issues related to the internet, including questions about elections, harmful content, and privacy. And while these are not antitrust issues and are not specifically the topic of today's hearing, I recognize that we are often at the center of these discussions. We build platforms for sharing ideas, and important debates play out across our services. I believe that this ultimately leads to more progress, but it means we often find ourselves in the middle of deep disagreements about social issues and high-stakes elections. I personally don't believe that private companies should be making so many decisions about these issues by themselves. And that's why last year, I made the case that there needs to be new regulation for the internet. Facebook stands for a set of basic principles: giving people voice and economic opportunity, keeping people safe, upholding democratic traditions like freedom of expression and voting, and enabling an open and competitive marketplace. These are fundamental values for most of us, but not for everyone in the world, not for every company we compete with or the countries they represent. And as global competition increases, there is no guarantee that our values will win out. I'm proud of the services we build and how they improve people's lives. We compete hard. We compete fairly. We try to be the best. That's what I was taught matters in this country. And when we succeed, it's because we deliver great experiences that people love. Thank you, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, and I thank the witnesses for your opening statements. Before I begin recognizing members for questioning under the five-minute rule, without objection, I'm going to enter into the hearing record the documents and exhibits majority members will be referencing in their questioning today. These materials have been distributed to the witnesses. I will now recognize myself for 5 minutes. Mr. Bachai, over 85% of all online searches go through Google. Every online company in the United States depends on Google to reach users. A business may sink or swim based on Google's decisions alone. Numerous online businesses told us that Google steals their content and privileges its own sites in ways that profit Google but crush everyone else. Most businesses asked to stay anonymous due to fears that Google would retaliate against them. One entrepreneur, Brian Warner, told us his website was thriving until Google stole his content. After Google's decision, traffic to his website dropped by 80%. He had to downsize his business and lay off half his staff. He told us, and I quote, "If someone came to me with an idea for a website or a web service today, I'd tell them to run as far away from the web as possible, launch a lawn care business or dog grooming business, something Google can't take away as soon as he or she is thriving." So my first question, Mr. Bachai, is why does Google steal content from honest businesses?
Mr. Chairman, with respect, I disagree with that characterization. Just last week, I met with many small businesses. In fact, today we support 1.4 million small businesses, supporting over $385 billion in economic activity. We see many businesses thrive, particularly even during the pandemic. Businesses, an example, Kettle Kings in Texas, which sells kettlebells,
I have a limited amount of time, so I don't want to interrupt you, but my question is very specific. We heard throughout this investigation that Google has stolen content to build your own business. These are consistent reports. And so your testimony that that doesn't happen is really inconsistent with what we've learned during the course of the investigation. But I'll move on to a new question. Mr. Bachai, most Americans believe that when they enter a search query that what Google shows are the most relevant results. But increasingly, Google just shows whatever is most profitable for Google, be it Google Ads or Google's own sites. So my question, Mr. Bachai, isn't there a fundamental conflict of interest between serving users who want to access the best and most relevant information and Google's business model, which incentivizes Google to sell ads and keep users on Google's own sites?
We have always focused on providing users the most relevant information, and we rely on that trust for users to come back to Google every day. In fact, a vast majority of queries in Google, we don't show ads at all. And we show ads only for a small subset of queries where the intent from users is highly commercial. For example, they may be looking for something like TV sets or so on.
But Mr. Bachai, what is the value of the part that you do use the Google ads for? I mean, it's a substantial part of your business. What's the actual value? $200 billion, $300 billion?
In terms of revenue, it's around $100 plus billion. Okay. But
that's a lot of money, Mr. Bachai. Let me move on. Mr. Bachai, it's Google's business model that is the problem. Our documents show that Google evolved from a turnstile to the rest of the web to a walled garden that increasingly keeps users within its sites. Emails show that over a decade ago, Google started to fear competition from certain websites, web pages that could divert search traffic and revenue from Google. These documents show that Google staff discussed the proliferating threat, is how it was described, that these web pages posed to Google. Any traffic lost to other sites was a loss in revenue. One of Google's memos observed that certain websites were getting, and I quote, too much traffic. So Google decided to put an end to that. Mr. Bachai, you've been at Google since 2004. Were you involved in these discussions about the threat from vertical search?
Congressman, without knowing the specifics, it's, I'm not fully clear of the context. But definitely, when we look at vertical searches, it validates the competition we see. For example, when users come looking to shop online, independent studies show that over 55% of product searches originate with Amazon, and over 70% originate with the major e-commerce companies. In the few categories which are commercial in nature, we see vigorous competition, be it travel, be it real estate, and we are working hard, focused on
users. Let me ask very specifically, Mr. Bachai. The evidence that we collected shows that Google pursued a multi-pronged attack. First, Google began to steal other web pages' content. For example, in 2010, Google stole restaurant reviews from Yelp to bootstrap its own rival local search business. Mr. Pichai, do you know how Google responded when Yelp asked you to stop stealing their reviews? Well, I'll tell you. Our investigation shows that Google's response was to threaten to delist Yelp entirely. In other words, the choice Google gave Yelp was, let us steal your content or effectively disappear from the web. Mr. Pichai, isn't that anti-competitive?
Congressman, you know, when I run the company, I'm really focused on giving users what they want. We conduct ourselves to the highest standard. Happy to engage, understand the specifics, and answer your questions further.
Thank you. And just one final series of questions, Mr. Pichai. Did Google ever use its surveillance over web traffic to identify competitive threats?
Congressman, just like other businesses, we try to understand trends from data which we can see, and we use it to improve our products for our users.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.